listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is the Motley Fool Money Mailbag.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money. Yep, it's our special Sunday Mailbag edition. Just a quick insight too. This is a Monday we're recording this, on a full week ahead, because we are already in the Christmas spirit, or at least the Christmas grind of making sure we have some podcasts for you when it comes to Christmas time. When I say we, of course, I'm talking about myself. I'm Scott Phillips, the Motley Fool's Chief Investment Officer here in Australia, and far more importantly, the straw man, Andrew Page. G'day, mate. How are you?
More importantly, I like it. Yeah, I'm good, mate. How are you?
Well, I figure, you know, I've got, you know, you make me look good is all I'm saying. So, you know, if you want to hear, I'm kidding. But you are remarkably important for this podcast, mostly because I did a solo podcast once when someone was away. I think it might have been Doc. And I got a message saying, hey, Scott, thanks for the podcast. Maybe next time if no one else is available, just skip a week. Which I figure was a kind way of saying, mate, you suck by yourself. So that's why you are so important, mate. If you're not here, I'm not sure if we have a podcast. If we do, I'm not sure anyone's listening. So let's just, I've got to big you up, mate. I've got to appreciate you because you're an important man. You are, of course, the managing director and the founder of strawman.com, which I'm reliably informed is a thing. What do you call it again?
It's an online investment club, as you well
that's
know.
That's right.
Yep.
A private online investment club, I think.
That's
I recall.
Correct.
Mate, we're not going to correct you. You've got to work on your marketing. Get those marketing minions doing their job, mate. The dozens out the back in the office who are grinding away to sell your business. You've got to get them working harder, I reckon.
We're not big on marketing, I'll be honest with you.
Nice. You don't need to be. People just knock on your door, mate. Why waste money if people are desperate to get in?
Look, it's the Groucho Marx thing, you know. We wouldn't want someone who, like, you don't want to be a member of a club that would have you, kind of thing. So if you're not super keen, then it's probably not a good fit. So
that's a good excuse. I reckon Groucho was knocked back. He's gone, oh, bugger, well, I didn't want to be there anyway.
Exactly.
I think that's how he's done it. Yeah. Anyway, hey, mate, should we ask some questions?
Let's do it, yeah.
Actually, more importantly, we'll answer some questions, but I will ask on behalf of our listeners. First one's from Shane, mate. Hi, Scott and Andrew. I've been meaning to let you guys know what an amazing job you do for quite some time. There you go. So thanks for the podcast, Motley Fool Money and The Good Oil. Oh, thanks for mentioning The Good Oil, Shane. I didn't even place that one, but The Good Oil with Scott Phillips at our other podcast. So check that. I've got some, can I say, mate, just in terms of like pre-Christmas, I have lined up a spectacular slate of people for the next couple of months
cool.
with interviews. So just stand by for that. And the ocean of financial education, says Shane, information, laughs, and common sense you guys provide. Do you reckon it's in that order? Education, information, laughs, and maybe that isn't all. Thanks also for the book recommendations, he says. I've been getting through them and feel my financial education has skyrocketed. One Up on Wall Street, wow. If this was the only investment book I ever read, it would likely be enough.
It's a good one.
Also, I think Andrew has mentioned this one, Your Money or Your Life. I'm now the guy that annoys all my family and friends by insisting they read this. My wife, who has no interest in finance, is currently devouring it. That's a good start.
Great.
I also should mention I'm a member of Extreme Opportunities Share Advisor and Dividend Investor. They're three Motley Fool services. I find all services great value. I'm also always interested and intrigued by the companies that are common to more than one of these services, or the rationale behind one service selling a company that another service continues to hold. I found that understanding the different treatment of companies by different services is beneficial due to the wealth of information provided and the views from different angles. I've also dabbled in Strawman. Not a member yet, he says. Sorry, Andrew. Fix that, Shane, will you? You've got to keep Andrew around, mate. I've just told you why. Join up. My question is, am I nuts owning all three services? It seems like Share Advisor is a mix of Dividend Investor and Extreme Opportunities. I know you are likely to be biased here, Scott. No. But what would be the pros and cons of having SA as my only service compared to holding DI and EO? I really like the excitement of Extreme Opportunities and the potential for multi-baggers. And I also like knowing I have some dull but stable income producing stocks from DI. However, Share Advisor could feasibly do the job of both these services, as it seems to capture the income producers and the growth opportunities. Perhaps you could also discuss the merits or not of a diverse portfolio of income producing growth and potential multi-baggers as part of a diverse portfolio of companies. Thanks for doing a great job and full on from Shane. I love that, mate. I'm going to do the first bit. I'll get you to do the second bit.
Mm-hmm.
Shane, here's the thing. SA is, so if you have a continuum from growth to income, SA sits, you're right, in the middle. And it is a mix to some degree, but it's kind of the mix of the middle of those. So it's probably the growth, your income stocks, and the more conservative of the growth stocks, if that makes sense. So if you draw your continuum, there's overlap for sure. But if you go from 0 to 100, then maybe EO goes from 0 to 33 and DI goes from 75 to 100. We probably cover, you know, 20 to 80. So ShareAdvisor has a bigger, broader remit. We don't do we're not as growthy as Extreme Opportunities at all. Nor do we need income, and we don't have that requirement for a relative. We don't. There's no hard minimum for dividend investor, by the way. But we don't need it, or we don't necessarily look for it. So it's kind of one of those things where the average income in dividend investor is higher. The average growth potential in EO is higher. ShareAdvisor kind of sits in the middle. So I wouldn't say you could replace SA by buying the other two, nor would I say if you bought the other two and not SA, sorry, bought SA only, you'd get all the best from both those other services. So that's kind of, it's not a straight line. These things are never straight lines. There is no growth value divide that people like to pretend. But if it is a continuum, we are literally smack dab in the middle at ShareAdvisor, and the other guys go further in either direction. So that's probably your answer, Shane. If you want more multi-baggers, then you're going to get more potential multi-baggers at Extreme Opportunities than at ShareAdvisor. Now, you might say, well, why would I get ShareAdvisor then? The answer is you're probably going to have more flameouts at EO. That's because that's exactly how they try and run the service. They deliberately are looking for big growth opportunities and prepared to take a whole lot of losses to get a handful of really, really, really fantastic companies. We're not as risk-seeking at ShareAdvisor. So, the reason I hold EO would be more, big multi-bags if that's what you're looking for. If you want more of those to choose from, you're not going to get them at ShareAdvisor. Equally, at Dividend Investor, you're not getting as much income from SA as you would from DI. So that's it's a bit of inside baseball, and we're talking about it because you asked, and other people have been interested in the past, by the way. So we do talk about our services occasionally. We try not to make it too marketing-y or salesy. I'm just telling you what you get. So, mate, if you like all three, great. If you like two out of those three, great. If you just want to buy one, that's cool too. And of course, if you are going to buy one, of course you'd buy ShareAdvisor. Sorry, Kevin and Ed, if you're listening. All right, Andrew. The question from Shane, then let's go. Perhaps you could also discuss the merits of a diverse portfolio of income producing, growth, and potential multi-bagger stocks as part of a diverse portfolio of companies. So I guess Shane's talking about kind of splitting his portfolio up, segmenting it mentally into the cool kids in finance supposed to call them sleeves. That's the new way to describe these things. A sleeve of growth stocks and a sleeve of income stocks and a sleeve of multi-baggers. Is that the way to approach building a diverse portfolio, do you reckon?
There's no... No, not necessarily. I think the more important thing is going before you even think about that is asking, what are your goals here? What are you trying to do? And that's particularly important when it comes to income, right? So if you're 73 and income is very important for you as opposed to capital gains, you're going to swing it that way, right? If you're 23 and you don't really need the income and you're after much, much bigger long-term capital gains, the growth is the way to go. So it depends on your goals and what you're trying to achieve. But if you're happy to have a mix of all, then that's okay too. Mm-hmm. But I would say that you've got to have a lot of clarity on the investment thesis and style that you're prosecuting with each particular investment, because it's easy for things to sort of overlap mentally for you.
Yeah,
you know, we've talked about this certainly off air, but probably on air too at a point is that. This thing called the share market, there's 1,000 different ways to skin this cat, and 999 of them probably are not going to be suitable to any one person. We all have our particular quirks and styles and biases and the rest of it. So it's know thyself is probably one of the most important mantras when it comes to investing. So you might be someone who is happy to buy a pretty ordinary company, but it's just dirt cheap. You're a deep value kind of person. Well, that's great. But it means that once that has been realized, once the market has corrected that deep discount, you'd probably sell it, right?
Yeah.
It's not this high quality compounder that's going to just decade after decade just go on making great returns. You've realized the investment thesis, you sell out. But that's exactly the wrong way to play it for the other style. So you've just got to be consistent, I think, at least on an individual basis if you are going to mix it up a little bit, because. Yeah. It just, to me, it doesn't make sense. And also, I think with income versus growth, I mean, your yardstick here is one of total return. So what is your total return with all the dividends and all the growth? Mm-hmm. And what I think a lot of income-focused people miss is that sometimes it's better to forego the income if you get a better total return.
Right.
Yes, it's not as consistent. You don't get the franking credits, but if the total return is higher, that after tax total return is higher, potentially, then that's probably one to focus on. So, yeah, look, there's not too many just outright wrong answers when it comes to investing, as long as you've got a lot of clarity on what it is you're doing, what you're trying to achieve, and whether it gels with you as a person and, you know, your persona, your style, your quirks, et cetera.
I love that, mate. Quick point. I'm going to answer a more broader answer on your last point just quickly. Talk about the amount of income you get and the total return. Westpac has probably paid an average of, 5% dividend over the last 5 years, something like 5% per annum, mm-hmm. probably, give or take. Mm. The shares are down 33% over that last 5 years. It's possible you might be roughly break even if you compound those dividends or something. If you're generous about when the dividends were paid and that kind of stuff, although, again, they're cut during the COVID crisis. So I'm gonna suspect that despite Westpac paying you out a pretty nice dividend for most of the time during that last 5 years, you're actually meaningfully behind the market. You're meaningfully down in total, right? You've actually lost money overall, even despite that. And that's your point about the way you think about the dividends versus the total return, right? Mm. If we do the same work for the ASX, the ASX is up 38% over that period of time. So not only have you probably lost money overall, you've missed the chance, even if you just bought the index, and again, you could do even better than that, you're getting a 38% return plus dividends, by the way. That's just the share price return. Mm. And so that's kind of Andrew's point. And that's, I've picked an example I knew the answer to, right? I knew Westpac had been terrible over the last 5 years. So I'm not saying every company is like that, but if you just look for income only and you ignore the quality of the business, you ignore the price you pay, you ignore the growth potential, that can be very expensive. You would have actually put money in the bank and just taken out 5% a year, and you have more money if you bought Westpac than if you bought Westpac shares. Mm. So that's worth thinking about. And Matt, I think you make a very good point.
One point I'd make, just on that as well, please. The better income stocks often, again, this is when you sort of look over a sort of 5-10 year period, so a reasonably long time frame. The better income stocks are often the ones that offer the lower yield. Yep. Which is a bit hard to wrap your head around. So let me explain it. So imagine, think of an example here. CSL is probably a good one, right? So back in 2013, let me bring it up, paying $1.10 per share. And given what they were sort of trading at the time, there's probably like a 1% or 2% yield. They never have had a high yield. Yep. But then, you know, that dividend doubled in the space of the next 3 or 4 years and then doubled again between sort of 2017 and 2021. So when you add up all, just forget the capital gains, which have been fantastic, by the way, just add up the dividends. I mean, it's a much better return than something that started with a 5% yield, but the dividend stayed the same every year. So what really matters, this is just generally true with investing, but even with income investing here, is that it's the future flow of that income stream that matters. And the yield is almost always quoted on a historical basis. So last year's dividend divided by the current share price works out a rough yield. And that's good. That's going to be your income return probably in the first year if they pay the same dividend again, which most often they will. Yep. But that's still going to be a pretty ordinary return, especially as you say, the capital doesn't go anywhere or goes down. But even if that dividend just stays the same, it's nowhere near as good as a dividend, a company who's increasing the dividend at 10 or 15% per year. And there's a lot of them out there. Yeah. They just get missed in a lot of, like, when people do scans and these kinds of things, because they understandably say, I want a high yield. And they look for these high yielding things. But the irony is that the total yield realized over a decade long period is probably nowhere near as good as the 1.5% yielding stock. So just factor growth matters. But always consider growth and factor it in.
Nice, mate. I think it's true. The other thing I'm actually gonna agree with you and then also provide an alternative or an additional view, which is just, as you said, the know yourself thing is really, really important, right? Or know thyself, to use the appropriate old English that you chose to use. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Which is, it sounds fancier that way.
It does.
I sound smarter. It's important to have a think about what you are looking for as an investor, which is exactly your point, mate. So, you know, if you're, even despite that, we run a service in the Motley Fool called Everlasting Income, where we literally just are focused on income, dividends, and some franking credits. And that's for people who are just like, you know what? I hear what you're saying, Andrew. I know total return's more important, but I'd like to know I've got the cash every 6 months in the bank, has got bills to pay.
Yeah, fair enough.
And that's one sort of investor, right? And as you say, the other sort of investor is, do the dividends even matter? If you buy an Amazon and a Tesla and an Afterpay, I don't think any of them paid a cent in dividends, right? And so you think about that group and say, well, yeah, you know what? That'd be pretty cool. I could fund a really nice retirement lifestyle if I'd bought them each you know, 5 years before their, well, I don't know, Amazon 5 years, 10 years ago, have to pay, you know, 5 years ago, Tesla 5 years ago. Yeah, probably about right, actually. 5 years. You know, so there are different ways of skinning the same cat. And I think that's your point of like, not only know yourself as an investor, but know what you're looking for specifically and what you're prepared to forego or not for the goals you're looking for. And to your point, mate, it's absolutely, you know, very likely, I think, we can't know for sure what the future brings. Very, very likely if you focus on income, you're probably going to give up some total return to do so. If you're specifically looking for income. That being said, we also know that in dividends over very long periods of time is about half the total return of the market. And so I also wouldn't ignore that. I think it's 4.5%, I think, annual interest, something like that for Australia in a market that goes about 10% a year, right? Mm. So again, now, of course, we're big in banks and there's reasons for all that stuff, but franking credits on top of that, there is absolutely value in getting those dividends as well. And or just simply saying, well, you know what, I like it, I'd like growth, but I want something with a little bit of dividend because I like just the cash flow, makes me feel good. And by the way, dividends can often mean companies are solvent and profitable and able to pay a dividend, all that kind of stuff that is actually a really good marker of quality. Probably less volatile in terms of total company performance over the long term, not in the short term. Anything's, Woolies went from 40 to 20 and back again, as I've said, 20 to 40 and back again, as I said before. So even Woolies is volatile if you pick the wrong time. But it's, know yourself, but also know your strategy and whatever strategy you're looking for. I would agree with you, mate, the total return, and then you can simply live off the income. But some people don't want to have to sell those shares, or they want the franking credits or whatever it is. Mm. So that can be important as well.
Can I add a little bit of an adjacency here? But I would go as far to say that companies should only pay out money that they don't have high confidence that they can reinvest at high rates of return. Maybe probably need to unpack that a little bit. But let's say you've got a business and it's just super profitable. You sell something that no one else does. There's huge demand for it. And if you earn $1 million in profit, now you pay that all out to your shareholders. Well, that's it's $1 million you don't have to reinvest in the business. Maybe you're getting a 30% return on money invested. That's going to be far more superior and with high degree of confidence. That's going to be far better than what most people will be able to get on their own. And so why would you want them to pay it out? Like, keep the damn money. If you think you can do that, I am going to be, as a shareholder, as an owner of this business, I am far, far, far better served. So, the flip side of it is companies that do keep money and get very low returns on equity and very low return on incremental equity, to be technically correct.
Yeah.
They're managing their capital woefully, and it's costing you as a shareholder. Some people, you know, companies will do it because they want to make an acquisition or they want to do this or that. But if it's not actually translating into any decent growth, they're wasting your money. Give the cash to me. You know, I'll buy an ETF with it or something like that. And you would be surprised at how just legion. That is so many ASX companies are guilty of that.
Yeah.
You know, just pay it out. Pay it all out. If you've got, but it takes a huge degree of honesty and self-awareness from a CEO to say, listen, we just don't have, we're a mature business. We don't have a lot of growth opportunities. We'll give the money to you. You invest it.
It's like what the banks have done, right? I mean, that's why yields from those banks are like, you know what? Between us all, we own 85% of the market. We can't really buy anything. We can't really grow meaningfully size-wise. And the billions and billions and billions and billions of dollars the banks have paid back over the last 5 or 10 years is better than them blowing it up trying to do something else.
Oh, true. Yep, 100% true. What really drives me crazy is you see this a lot too, is a company will pay out all these dividends and then raise money to do something else. You know, maybe for a specific acquisition, okay, fair enough, but to accelerate growth, we're doing this and we're taking on more debt. And it's like, you wouldn't have needed to if you didn't pay out all of those, you know, hundreds of millions in dividends. If you've if you're sitting there in the boardroom going, wow, we've got a cracking hot opportunity here, don't pay the damn dividend. Now, of course, what makes that very hard is because there's some unspoken rule that a contract between the company and the shareholders, we want our dividend. But that's shareholders being silly. They're not thinking of the big picture here. And that really needs to be the lens through which all dividends are viewed. And some companies get it And it's no surprise that those companies that do, that manage their capital really well, also by raising capital when the share price is high, buying shares back when they think that just leads to such immense shareholder wealth creation. But too few companies are focused on it because they're giving the people what they think they want and not what they need.
Yeah, that's right.
And it drives me a bit crazy.
Exactly. Just quietly. I completely agree. I got to say, man, I tend to be the devil's advocate, generally speaking. So when you're saying that, I'm also starting to think the opposite. But also, you've gone both ways, which makes it hard.
Disagree.
No. I was more the point that I'm an optimist by nature, but I'm also someone who has taken Charlie Munger's idea to heart. Never think about anything else when you should be thinking about incentives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I love the idea of a company retaining capital to invest it, right? I love that. I have been around way too long to think that that's often and always a good idea, because even with the best of intentions, they still manage to screw it up.
Mm.
You know what I mean? It's one of those. It's one of those situations where, like, I don't know if I want money burns holes in CEOs and boards' pockets too easily, right?
It does.
We've got this cash. We have to do something with it. Let's do something with it. Mm. Like, oh no, they don't. Mm. You know, they make some stupid acquisition or you know, try and build a new empire of some description or other.
Go into a completely different market, or, you know, expand into China.
Well, speaking about banks, right? NAB went to the UK, screwed that up. Went to America, screwed that up. ANZ went to Asia, screwed that up. Like, at some point, it's like, guys, just
colossal waste of money.
I take your point about don't pay it out, you know, reinvest it if you can. I just think if we actually handicapped management's egos, there'd be a whole lot more dividends being paid, put it that way. Mm. You know, like, it's one of those, like, do I want them to chase growth if they can get it? Of course. But we're not going to know until after the fact. And no CEO is a shrinking violet who thinks, I'm actually not very good at this job. I won't try and grow because I'll probably screw it up. Every CEO is like, I've got the best idea ever. You watch this.
Mm.
And I don't know, mate. Like, I'm really torn, because you're right. Like, Buffett paid a dividend once in 1965 and then never again, right? And shareholders have been eternally blessed by that. I own Berkshire shares, as our listeners well and truly know, but I should disclose it anyway. So you know what? Absolutely. Others who went and blew up money acquiring rubbish stuff. iCenture comes to mind, right? A recommendation of ours that went and bought King content and literally wrote down to exactly zero, right? They just should have gone at the back, lit a bonfire and torched the money. At least they would have saved on investment bank fees, right?
Like, yes.
It was just stupid.
Yeah.
And so you kind of go, I don't know, mate. I want the retained money to grow. I do. I wonder at some level, if you at least see the dividend cash, you can choose, as you say, where to put it. Now, we all have our own arrogance, and we think we can invest the money as well, right? So management doing it on behalf of the company, we're doing it on behalf of ourselves, and both are making the same judgment calls or trying to. I don't know. What do you think of that?
Yeah, well, look, this is the thing that I think what I was saying is theoretically true, but but there's this little thing called execution risk. So, and there's just this little thing called the life and the universe that we live in, which is just very, very complex and ever-changing, and no one's got any perfect foresight. So the best intentions, the best reasoning, the best strategy, which just looks perfectly sensible, can turn out to be wrong. And we can give management a hard time about that. So, yeah, that's a totally valid point. So you as an investor do have to judge the merits of the strategy as stated, and whether they've got the ability to execute on that. That's probably where I spend a very substantial chunk of my time when looking at a business, because it is so important, and yet it's so hard to answer. It's not in any ratio. It's not in any financial statement.
Yeah,
you know, it's a very slippery thing to kind of nail down. But it's everything. It's everything. You name all of the great businesses that you – what did you say before? Like, you know, the Teslas and the Amazon. You know, there's not many Elon Musks out there or Jeff Bezos out there. And by the way, both of these gentlemen have got some very unsavory characteristics to their characters. But in terms of running –
allegedly, and Andrew said that, not me.
But, well, I'll sue him. But hey, credit where it's due. They are very visionary. You know, they've executed extraordinarily well. Yes. And those people are rare, you know. Use a golf analogy. There's not many Tiger Woods out there. So, you know, it's all good and well for me to describe the perfect golf swing to you. You put me on a golf course. I don't play golf,
so what
by
you
the
have
way.
To do, Tiger, but Tiger, Tiger. What you got to do is.
It's just like I might say everything right, but I am just going to like hack that grass up and bend my club like nobody's business. You're right. You're 100% right. But that's the challenge. That's what you're trying to figure out. That's a big part of what you're trying to figure out.
Very, very good. Mate, simple question.
Okay.
Well,
simple question for a simple man. I'm ready.
Short, no, short question. Not an easy answer. Easy question.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Gareth says, I still feel like an inflationary environment is going to be scary for good stocks with high PEs. Do you worry about PE compression? In other words, do you worry that if inflation goes up, rates come up, PEs come down, price earnings ratios come down, as they should, assets should be less expensive or cost less when interest rates are higher. By definition, that's the way the investment maths works. Do you worry, mate, about price earnings compression for companies you own?
Yep, a lot. So if
to the point of doing something about it or the point of just going, that would suck?
Yeah. No, I think I've been doing something about it for a while.
Have you?
Yeah. So when you look at you quoted the market's returns before.
Yes.
Now, the biggest driver of share price and market returns are profits and how they grow. So if you were just to like plot a bar chart of the profit of the every ASX listed company, you kind of see this sort of pretty even staircase going bottom left, top right, and you'd have this share price moving all over the place. But it kind of anchors to that. It's kind of there's an attractor that's there that sort of draws it back when it gets too high and pulls it up when it gets too low over time and eventually kind of thing.
Yeah.
But on top of that, you do have to layer the stretchiness of that, the elastic band, if
the
you will,
stretchiness
that connects that share price with that, and that's what PEs do. And so.
Yep.
So what I'm getting at here is when you look, so this is fact before we get to the theory and forecast. The fact is of the matter over the last, I don't know, probably 10 years almost really, certainly last 5 years, a big part of the market's returns have been that multiple expansion, as they put it. Yes, earnings have generally gone up, but what's also gone up is how much people are prepared to pay for each dollar of earnings. Now, if that reverses, you can get a scenario where earnings continue to rise, but the multiple falls and overall it's a wash. Or, in fact, it could even be down. And if we go into a higher interest rate environment, that is definitely the case. So we've talked a lot about this on the podcast, but my general view is that I can't predict this kind of stuff and I've never seen anyone who can. But correct. I do know that whenever I'm buying shares that have a very high multiple, I need to be confident of two things, one of two things. Either the earnings growth is going to be so substantial as to offset any PE compression, or that the PE is going to stay high. Mm-hmm. And that's hard. I mean, it's hard enough to try and forecast what a company is going to be earning in 5 years' time.
That's right.
To know what mood the market is going to be in 5 years' time is diabolically. Yeah. You can't do it. Anything could happen. So I find it a much riskier proposition. So I've left, as it turns out, a lot of money on the table by avoiding companies with very high multiples or selling out of some of my companies or at least selling down in some of my companies when the multiples have gotten too high. Because I don't want to – it's not that my view of the company has changed, but all of a sudden my future returns are now much more dependent on this crazy Mr. Market being in a good mood, which is not something that makes me particularly comfortable. Now, as it turns out, I probably could have ridden that a lot longer in a lot of other situations and I would have been great, but it's a game of chicken to me, and I feel as though it's a little risky. There's actually, I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there's lots of examples of this kind of stuff where the market gets so super excited about a company and just shoots the multiple up to the stratosphere. And you look back 5 years later and the share price has gone nowhere overall. But actually look at the business and like, well, actually everything that people were sort of saying kind of came true, right? Like business went on and grew very well. It's just that shareholders paid. You can do really badly as an investor by investing in a really, really great company. Nothing is, quote Charlie Munger no company is worth an infinite amount. And, you know, so I don't know, I said CSL before. Great Aussie company. Would I buy that for $10 million a share? No. Because no matter what that thing does, you can compound its profit.
$1 billion valuation is probably too much.
Yeah, it's too much. I'm never going to do well at it because at some point in the future, people are going to go, well, I'm not going to pay that. Why would I do that? And it's certainly worth more than a dollar a share. So it's just logic, right? Like between a dollar and $1 trillion, there's something that makes sense. I think you do need to be careful with that kind of stuff. And it's tricky. It's tricky because what you can do is you can buy companies or avoid companies on that basis and then have the market just rub your nose in it for the next 6, 12, 24, 36 months, you know. Investing is the art of looking really silly for long periods of time and that's if you do it well. So,
yeah, sure as, go on.
Yeah, well, eventually you're hopefully proven right and that's what you're trying to do. But, you know, it's just this idea that to do well on the market is what, you know, people often think you need to have a high strike rate. So almost everything you buy turns out to be well. That's not true. You can have a terrible strike rate and still do well. But the other misconception I think is that a stock that goes well immediately. And they just generally don't. All of the great investments, they often languish for often years, or the market just misses them for a while until it can no longer be ignored because of the incredible earnings growth that is realized in there. Anyway, I'm rambling. What do you think?
I can't add much, so I'm probably not going to, other than to say reinforce your original point around you either need to pay a good price for current earnings or expect that future earnings are going to make up for any PE compression and or inflation. And that is literally the key point, right? So, Amazon's a wonderful example. Amazon might be worth $2,500 a share rather than $3,000 a share in a higher inflation environment. But if you bought it at $9, you really don't care. So, you know, there's NIO.
Because the earnings growth offset the compression.
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. The business growth is just so phenomenal. In Amazon's case, earnings growth was zero back then, so it didn't have an E actually, so it wasn't a PE. But you know what I mean? That kind of idea of a business that grows fast enough. And by the way, it has to justify itself to grow like that. The other thing I wanted to add was in terms of thinking about the way you consider future price, like, you know, shareholders will pay, or in other words, will pay a price in a future point, but hoping that someone might possibly pay more than you at some point because of some sort of boom, to Andrew's point, would be really silly. So when Andrew said, look, I sold because I thought it was just too expensive, the fact that other people keep paying you more is not evidence you're wrong necessarily. It may be in the fullness of time, by the way, but if you sold shares in Enron at 40 and they went to 50 or 60, oh man, I was an idiot. See, I was wrong. The market, they're bankrupt and they're worth nothing. So, you know, were you wrong when the shares went to 60? No, that's just life. That's just volatility and you never pick the top, right? So you're not picking something because it's the top. You're saying because cost benefit, you know, risk reward, I don't think it's worth owning anymore. Doesn't mean the shares can't go higher. They almost certainly will because that's what happens in life. And again, to your point, mate, this leads into another question I'll ask, but I'll just very quickly say that you've got to be careful, as you said, to assume the market's going to see it your way straight away. Because that is the problem, right? Yeah. You're like, I bought the shares, now they're down. What's going on?
What did they get wrong?
Well, the market didn't know you bought the shares, and even if it did, it wouldn't all of a sudden change its mind. You know, I'm no oracle, right? If I buy shares tomorrow, everyone in the market does go, oh, Scott bought shares. Oh, he's a genius. Yep. Okay, well, let's put the share price up. Like, no, we didn't like it yesterday. You bought it today. I'm not going to like it tomorrow just because you bought it. So, you know, whatever happens to the share price will happen independent of your purchase. Again, on the same as the way up. If you sold it at 40, you weren't wrong because it then went to 60. On the flip side, if you had Amazon at 100 and then it went to 9, you weren't wrong because it fell because then it went up to 3,000. And so that same logic applies, which takes me to, mate, have you got your drinking glass handy?
Yes.
We had a couple of questions from Jordan and Wombat. Kogan, so I'll get to this quickly. It is Kogan.
Drink.
I've actually got three questions on it. So I'll answer a couple. The other one was the same. Just because we're being asked a bit about it, they know I own the share, so I'll do them the honour of replying, then we'll move on. Hi, Scott, says Jordan, would love your thoughts on Kogan's recent announcement. Drink, he says. And if your thesis has been challenged, I should say. As an investor, I'm seriously concerned regarding Kogan's corporate governance and its 2026 prediction, which seems like a Hail Mary to keep investors around and excited. I'm a long-term investor, but my conviction for this company is waning, and I'm considering decreasing my position to allocate to higher conviction companies. Look forward to hearing on the mailbag. And then Wombat says, question for the next podcast as requested. Thank you, mate. Why is Kogan having such a bad run? He also asks about Smart Group. He says, hashtag long-term investor, not panicking, and a smiley face with sunglasses. I don't know if that emoji has a name, but that's the emoji he's given us. I think it's a bloke, Wombat. Either way. Mate, so this is a good question. I'm going to quickly touch on it, then I'm going to get you to touch on it, then we'll move on. So we won't spend too much time on this one. We've covered Kogan a lot. So first things first, Jordan, if you are losing conviction, you have better conviction elsewhere, then change. I'm not changing, but if you know, Andrew's said many, many times, I'm going to steal your word here, mate, you can borrow an idea, but you can't borrow the conviction. If you don't have enough conviction, then by all means, go and buy something you have more conviction. I'm not going to try and tell you not to just because I own the shares. I think they're a buy right now, right? But if you don't agree, then cool. Go and do what you feel better about because you're more likely to hang on. If the shares keep falling and you eventually sell in some sort of capitulation, that's worse than selling now. So if you're going to sell, sell early. That being said, it's hardly early and the shares are down a bit, quite a lot actually. over the last little while. We're recording this on Monday morning, by the way, before the market opens, after the Omicron news on the weekend. So goodness knows what's happening by the time you're listening to this podcast. We can only say what's happening now. So look, that's the first thing. Second thing, confidence tends to wane when share prices fall. If you didn't know the share price right now, if the market was closed, had been closed for the last 18 months, and you saw the numbers from Kogan, would you feel would you have similarly reduced conviction, or is the share price seeking in? Now, I can't tell you which is which, so I'm not going to tell you what the answer to that is. I'm not even going to assume that's your view, but it's natural for anybody to be like, oh my God, I bought it at 15, now it's 12, now it's 10, now it's 8. Oh my God, I'm an idiot. I don't really, and now I'm seeing this bad news and maybe it's all right and maybe I should reconsider and now I'm reconsidering, and you get the idea. So that's the question. In terms of corporate governance, I have no issues with their corporate governance. They got a second strike on their salary remuneration thing, this is a whole different rant, Ram. This whole shareholder voter remuneration, I think, is the world's most stupid idea. Fundies use it to complain about remuneration or about corporate strategy or about a falling share price. It's kind of like, you know, to a man with a hammer, every problem's a nail. Mm. There is one nail, and it's the remuneration vote. And the shareholders could vote to spill the directors, but they don't. They vote on the remuneration report to make a point, right? Oh, second strike for Kogan, it's in the news. What can we do to make you guys not vote for, you know? It's a little bit of leverage. And it's being used. I think the whole thing is stupid. Not that I'm saying remuneration isn't too high. That's entirely different. This non-buying remuneration vote is dumb. Anyway, so I don't have a problem with their corporate governance at all, personally. Revenue prediction, I'm going to say to you, Jordan, I actually don't know what that number is. And I have no problem not knowing what that number is, because I'm not, you know, every company will tell you how great their future is going to be, right? If I'm investing based on company press release, I'm doing something wrong. I'm not saying you are, by the way. That 2026 number has no interest to me. I don't know what it is. I can't remember what it is. I probably have read it a few times, I'm sure. I can't remember what the number is. What I have looked at is growing sales and growing gross profits, and I have a conviction they will turn that into net profit, bottom line profit at some point, at an increasing rate, and that is my basis for liking the company. That's it. Over time, more profits, more sales, more gross profit, more sales. If they can keep those customers, convert those customers, get economies of scale to start working well for them, the profits will come. Unless they completely screw it up, which is possible, right? But if you have a company that's growing top line at 50% and gross profit at 50%, as long as that's reasonably continuable, you would have to do an almighty, a colossal job to screw that up. And it's possible, right? Maybe they screw it up. But the odds are very, very good that they won't. The odds in general, if you had a company with those attributes, very unlikely they're going to screw that up to the point where you're going to lose meaningful amounts of money. So that's why I have conviction on Kogan. That's my view. Yes, Wombat, to your point, why is it having such a bad run? So it's a related question, Ram. And this goes back to what I was saying about your answer before. It's having a bad run because investors don't like it. Mm. They're losing conviction and selling. Mm. Now, as I said, maybe this is Enron on the way out. Or maybe this is Amazon on the way down before it goes back up again. We can't know. No one can know. Right, but in the short run, if you're asking why, the answer is always, always, always sentiment, unless the numbers are getting materially worse. And frankly, went from 12 to 8 over the last year, probably made a think, something like that, close enough to it. Drifted away because investors wanted something exciting. They didn't get the exciting stuff and they think the shares are worth less. Now, maybe it is worth less. Maybe it's worth 25% less. No, a third less, sorry. Possible. I don't think so. I think the growth numbers still remain really strong. In fact, were very, very good. So I have no issue with the growth trajectory. So you can argue that the business is getting worse, that the future is worth less than it was 12 months ago. Potentially, that's absolutely an argument you could make. I think that's really unlikely. And again, I could be wrong as well. I'm giving you a confident answer, but not a certain answer. You mentioned the other week, Ram, high conviction. Was it something strong? Strong opinion is loosely held. I have a strong opinion that Kogan will improve. The market doesn't agree with me right now. One of us is right. But remember, this is the thing with Walmart and Jordan, just before I'll wrap up and let Ram jump in, you can't let the market tell you what to think. You just can't. So why is it having a bad run? Does it matter? No. Again, if the market was closed, would you pay, are you happy with the performance of the company? The fact the shares are falling in the meantime either means there's something out there that is real that you should take account of and pay less for, which is the first thing, or the market's just changed its mind. And either of those things are okay if your view is Kogan is going to be a successful business in 2025 and 2030 and whatever else in the future, then the falling share price in the meantime is completely useless. If you think the business is worth less now because of the numbers, then the market might be right and you should reconsider. Or, by the way, the shares have already fallen, so the question now isn't why have they fallen, but is it good value at today's price? Over to you, mate.
I think the market, this is a good example of what we were talking about before, I think. So Kogan, I don't hold Kogan, but I don't hate it. I think Ruslan's done an incredible job. You know, he started this literally in his mum's garage, this business. And, you know, even a few years ago, it was earning about 15 cents a share and pre-pandemic about 30 cents a share. They doubled their profit per share in a couple of years. I just brought up the forecast. CommSec sort of give a consensus forecast from what the various brokers who contribute to it. They're sort of saying that this thing could be earning back to, so COVID really knocked them about a bit, but they could be sort of back to 30-odd cents, 32 cents on the consensus. Yep. You know, look, let's not put too much weight in that. Analysts are often wrong, but just... Well,
that's exactly right.
But I'm just putting it out there, right?
Yep.
Just as a stake in the ground here. Mm-hmm. Call it 40 cents. Maybe they exceed forecast by 30%, you know?
Yeah.
I still think what you're seeing here is that the market has actually been correcting previous overzealousness. Mm-hmm. So look at the business. The business is going really well. There's pretty good reason to expect for it to continue to go really well. Mm-hmm. Was it worth $25 a share? Not for me. That's where the market got wrong. So what we're seeing here is a PE compression of a very significant degree. It's actually now getting interesting. I just had a very quick look, and based on those numbers on a forward basis, it's still up there, still a PE of 26 or something like that. But it's actually it seems to me as there was just too much exuberance in the price. And this is, as I said, great example of what we were talking before. Is it a good business? Yeah. Was it worth $25 a share? I don't know. To me, that seems. And at that point in time, that was on a trailing PE of, I mean, 96. Mm. Now, it's not a technology company. You know, it's not zero. It's not 100% gross margin, infinitely scalable global market. You know, it's very much Australian focused. So it's a limited market size. They need to buy inventory to do all of this. In fact, that was the bit of the sort of the story behind their woes recently. They overstocked and all of this other kind of stuff. Retail's hard. Retail is super hard, and it's not any less hard because you're competing against literally the biggest, baddest, most ruthless retailer in the world, which is Amazon. Not that's a thesis killer for me, but it means that when it was trading at a PE of 96, it was just silly. And now it's actually getting to a point where it makes sense. So I'd look at it more through that lens than what the share price has done. So as you've often said, either the market was wrong before or it's wrong now. I feel as though what you've seen in this instance, my guess is the market was wrong before and it's probably right now. And so the other difficult decision is, I suppose, is if you did buy at $25. Now there's a sliding spectrum all the way down. We can argue the toss as to what point it became sensible,
right?
But it sucks. I'm sorry that it's done that, and you know I'm no stranger to that feeling and that experience. But the question really is today, you've got X dollars in Kogan. Would you put that much money into it today? Based on, regardless of what you lost, you can't change, you can't go back in time, but you can reallocate that capital. So if you're looking at all of the 2,000 different shares out there and you feel as though Kogan at the current price is one of the better opportunities out there, then leave your money there. Maybe add some more to it. But that's the question though. The question isn't, should I sell because it's gone down? The question is, should I sell because there's no longer value at the current price or there's not value at the current price? That's the question you need to ask. If you blink into existence today, you know, everything before was just the fervid dreams of a madman. You know, and you're just, here you are. And
you're very lyrical today.
And you find yourself holding this particular portfolio with this particular company in there with a particular weighting in it. Yeah. If you're happy with that based on what you see of the future, then keep on it. If you don't, and this is what you said, then sell. But yeah, I actually think it's now getting interesting.
The other analogy we've used is if your entire portfolio was sold this afternoon, would you buy it back tomorrow?
Yes,
in the same proportion, right? Same thing as you said. Yeah, if you inherited this portfolio with this size, or if you blinked into existence, as you said more lyrically, or if you did. Now, I will say, mate, for what it's worth, I still think Kogan is dramatically undervalued, And it comes down to your point about, you know, 20 times trailing earnings is really, really cheap for a business that can grow at 20% for a really long time if it achieves those things. Now, the if is the smallest big word in the English language, right? Mm-hmm. If this, if that. Man, you know, if my grandmother had wheels, she'd be a bicycle, as the old quote goes. If I could only pick the top 15 performing stocks over the next 10 years, I'm going to be a squillionaire. You know, if. The if is a tiny, tiny word, but it means everything. So the question for, I think it's really cheap at $8. Had I not been answering this question right now, I would be buying shares this week, put it that way. Mm-hmm. Now, that's each to their own, and I might be entirely wrong. I think that 20 times trailing earnings looks really cheap if it can keep growing sales and earnings at that sort of rate. You don't have to grow earnings at 20% a year for very long to make these numbers look. I mean, yeah, people paying, let me find out for a second. Now, very different business, right? I'm going to quickly pull up some numbers before I give away what I'm saying. Woolies, people are paying 33 times earnings for Woolies, which is growing at about, it's going to grow at 6% a year, right? You're paying 20 times earnings for Kogan. Again, Woolies might be overvalued, Kogan might be undervalued. They might both be overvalued. I think in a relative sense, I think Kogan is good value. Now, again, could be wrong. I wouldn't overweight it in the portfolio. Don't go and sell your house and buy Kogan shares. If you own it, great. If you don't own it, great. I would buy some, but that's up to you. So, and Andrew and I have a different view, which is awesome. So one of us is going to be right and Andrew's going to be, I mean, one of us is going to be wrong. So we'll see how we go from there.
So I would not, yeah, well, I just clarifying that it's
yeah, sure.
I feel as though in this game, particularly if ever you're on TV or radio or something like that, you have to have the, oh, this is what I think. And this is definitely what it is. Yeah, and yeah. And I was whinging to you the other day about that. And to me, it's just like there's nothing wrong, absolutely, to my mind at least. Maybe it just makes me feel better. But there's nothing wrong with just sort of saying, I just don't know.
Yep,
So it's not, I don't want to be painted here as the Kogan bear. I'm far from it. I don't have strong feelings. As I said, I think it's actually looking quite interesting. Last time I did a valuation on Strongman for it, it came about $12, right? So it's
there you go.
See that, so I'm not bearish on it. I'm just saying is that I've got other opportunities which I think I've just got higher conviction in personally.
Yeah, totally.
And the explanation for it for me at least was, you know, based on my little back of the envelope calculation, was that sort of above 12, it just didn't make a huge amount of sense. Yeah, I was going to say something else and it's completely escaped. So, yeah, let's move on.
Let's move to a question from Cameron, mate, because it's kind of related and kind of fun. Hi, Scott and Ram. First name only, please. Luckily, I did. Long-time listener, first-time questioner. Thank you for throwing one in. You talk about being a long-term investor and beating the market, but often it takes time for your thesis to play out.
Often.
So how do you go
almost
about...
Almost always for me.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, I talk about that, and it must, right? By definition, it must. If you're a long-term investor... Even if things go well in the short term, the something that's had a long term will still work well. And that's almost the point, right? If the shares go up in 3 months, your thesis hasn't played out. The shares have just gone up. That's a whole different thing.
Yeah.
All right. So how do we go about beating the market year on year? Is it a case of not worrying about 1 year performances, or is it simply a case of diversification so that your theses play out at a different over different time periods? Cheers from Cameron. It's a good question. So easy to be a long term investor, or say you're a long term investor. You've got a portfolio and you're having a rough year and things are tough. Do you kind of ignore the 1 year time periods? Do you try and have different companies with different things going on so that you have, different kind of expectations? How do you think about that, mate?
I think that the significance of a year is that it's the time it takes for the Earth to do a full orbit around the sun.
Oh, it's gone from English literature to science. I love it. This is the Renaissance podcast.
I like a bit of astronomy, I do. But that's kind of it, right?
Why else does it matter?
That's a pretty good reason. It's as good as anything to sort of set the basis of how we sort of measure time.
Track some time. Yep.
But
that's right.
Yeah. But what does that mean? I mean, I've never bought a company based on what I think it's going to do in the next year. You know, I would also say that, again, do a study of all the great investors out there. They have many long and extended and frequent periods of underperformance. Mm-hmm. They do. But by definition, I've just given, that they've gotten incredible long-term returns. Yeah. And you often find that the returns really come in these short bursts where they just make insane. Then you'll have periods where it's like, oh my God, their return was 80% this year. And then people get crazy again. Yeah. They go, oh, they can do that every year. And it's like, no, just the growth, the returns come as a function of sort of, you know, two steps backward, three steps forward, one step backwards, four steps forward, five steps backwards, and then two steps forward. It's this stumbling drunkard that's wandering through the village. But you know, they're making their way to the pub. Sooner or later, they're getting there. They're just stumbling backwards quite often along the way. And so, yeah. What matters is what the business is doing and its prospects. There are some incredible, incredible businesses that just got knocked for six during COVID. Now, none of the CEOs could have foreseen that. No one on earth foresaw it. No CEOs. Most companies couldn't have really done anything about it, even if they did see it coming.
Yeah, that's right.
And then there'll be something else next year, or you know, whatever. You can only sort of look through it in the lens of, hey, I like this business because overall, over time, not by the time the Earth is in this same position next year, it will be doing better. I really think that for me, a minimum sort of forecast period tends to be about 3 years and usually longer. I'm trying to sort of cast that's I actually think I've said it repeatedly. I think that's one of the few remaining edges we have as private investors, is thinking beyond the next year, because I guarantee you every stockbroker and sell side analyst and out there, they're all working on a year, because they're all trying to get their bonus. That's how they're measured against a benchmark over these periods. And they're all trying to play this game. This is a very hard game. If you can sort of look beyond all of that, That's a massive, massive, massive edge. So there's no significance in a year. All that matters is that the business remains attractive and the outlook remains bright, and the price relative to that expectation makes sense. As long as those things line up, keep on holding and buy more. It will out in time, guaranteed. If you're right, there's that big little word again. If you're right, I will guarantee that. I will guarantee that. Go back to Kogan as an example. If they grow their earnings at 20% compound over the next 5 years, I will bet you my firstborn, my left arm, you name it, that their share price will be much higher than it is today. There is a financial gravity at play there, where the market just can't ignore certain things after a point in time. So that's the way to look at it. Forget about the year, the month, the quarter. You know, companies release information on these cycles, so I guess there's some relationship there that you only get an annual result once a year, and that helps you sort of, you know, make sure that you're on target and things are still fitting with your thesis and all of that kind of stuff. But it's not something I think a hell of a lot about.
I can't do much more than that. The market's not going to think you're right just because you are. We've given plenty of examples. Apple, Amazon, Tesla went nowhere for 5 years straight. Actually went down. I think I gave the numbers a few podcasts ago, Andrew. Mm. Tesla, it was something like a 5 year period or 4 year period where Tesla shares were down.
Yeah.
Right? And now they're up like 100-fold or something. Like stupid difference.
Well, why? Why is that? Was the market changed? Oh, yeah. Obviously the market changed its mind, but it changed its mind because the numbers were there, right? Like the sales just exploded in all of those examples. Now the market can ignore that for a while. But it's not going to ignore it. We can't ignore it forever.
And sometimes it is performance, right? Sometimes it does make more profit, but it's the delivery of a thesis you already had, which is, I think, in a few years' time, Tesla will make some decent money, and at that point, it'll be worth more.
Yeah.
And that's also true, right? And the market is catching up to some degree. So 1 year, no. Different theses, no. Although, if you're dollar cost averaging and you do it for long enough, there's a decent chance your theses do play out sort of not sequentially, because some just go badly, some happen soon, some happen a long time later. But if you're kind of investing regularly, it will almost be the case that just simple law of averages means that something is moving in one direction while something's moving somewhere else, and you do end up with a flattening out. But no, if you like the idea, you like the thesis, who cares how long it takes to play out? I mean, if it takes a million years, you lose money. But don't buy on that. Mate, one last one to finish off. And this is a more theoretical question, but it's not stock specific. It's about a young person. I hate young people because they're too young, as we said before. They have something I will never have, and that is more time on this earth. And that makes me grumpy, and because I'm a grumpy old man. Get off my lawn. Nick asks, thanks for answering my question on the podcast. You're welcome, Nick. With the plethora of free information and advice online, would you recommend young people see a financial advisor, or are they a waste of money?
Ooh.
Is that a good question?
That's a good question.
Oh, he's laughing already. This is going to be good. Sit back, relax. Here we go.
I think the financial advisory industry, it's like any industry. I'd say there's doctors, of pilots, of people like us. You know, there's kind of an 80-20 rule out there. And teachers, it's just fireys. You know, just there are just some people that are just so exceptional that they're worth every cent. They're probably, you could pay 10 times as much and still get incredible value. And then you have this big, long, fat tail of mediocrity and incompetence. And that's true in the financial advice game. Yep, right. So any financial advisors listening out there, I'm sure you're one of the good ones. And if you are, you're...
By definition, they're listening to Motley Fool money.
Well, you know, but I mean, and I don't want to... It's really wrong to generalize and say they're all crooks because they're not. There is some
never, just, ever, ever generalize.
Never, ever generalize. But so the question here is, yes, it's worth seeing one if you know of a good one. I actually don't because I don't use one given what I do for a job.
That's the hardest, That's one question I never answer when people ask, who should I go and see? I have no idea.
I just don't know. I know that there is plenty of bad ones out there and I know there are some really good ones out there.
Right, exactly.
Generally speaking, it's the ones that you talk about incentives before, like some of them will have, there's some incentives out there as to recommend certain products because that's the ones they get trailing commissions on or something like that. I don't think they're really looking after you. I think they're looking after you. And we had a Royal Commission that kind of unequivocally demonstrated that in certain ways. So it's a hard one. It's not a satisfying answer, but that's my answer.
I don't have much more to add, mate. I think the best use of financial advice is structural. So that is, if you're going to be adding lots of money, if you want to invest in a family trust or a company structure of your own, understanding kind of where you're sitting financially is important. If you need advice on insurances and things like wills and estate planning, that's stuff the average person can't do well to be able to navigate the stuff that's online. There's so much stuff online. It's all broad and vague. So that stuff I think is more useful. Paying an advisor every year for potentially no change, particularly if they're charging you a percentage of your assets. I've said before, my mother was being charged almost 2% per year from a financial advisor for going to see him for half an hour a year.
What a crook. I'll say it. Mate. You didn't name him, so I'll just say that. You know, it just makes you sick, doesn't it?
It really does. Mum has not got a heap of money, but enough money that it was highway robbery. The dollar value she was paying was just stupidly large.
For what?
Right.
Now, if he was doing something that made her like, you know, ridiculous returns, then worth every cent. I bet he didn't though. I'm just going to go out there.
And the structural stuff up front, I'm sure was worthwhile. Yeah. But every single year, that's the bit that annoys me. The only problem I will say is most financial advisors won't take you on for much less than a very large lump sum up front, make their time worthwhile apparently. I don't have a good answer to that problem yet. I'm working on it. It's one of those, they have a lot of paperwork to do and a lot of obligations. And so I spoke to a couple of financial advisors only recently to get some structural advice, which I was talking about. And they both said, I can't take you on for less than $2,500 or $3,000 up front. I'm like, man, I'm not paying. And I said, nice, I'm not paying that. And they said, this guy, I get it. Like, no, it wasn't bad. It wasn't. He was like, this is what it's going to cost me to, you know, if I take on a new client, that's how much I charge because of all the setup and paperwork and time and effort and energy. So it can be hard. I wouldn't pay that sort of money. But if you get a good financial advisor, give you structural advice, Nick, it might be worth
very, very quickly, Max. I know we're running out of time, but I think generally speaking, the big ideas in investing and finance, they're not hard. It's kind of like, I think a good analogy here is with health and fitness. So you can go see a personal trainer, you can go on a really, you know, scientific diet kind of thing and you know, it'll do you wonders. Or you can be the kind of person who just takes the time to do 10,000 steps a day, doesn't eat too much sugar and a bit of fruit and veg. You know, that's really good. And I think the same is true of finance. So you can be right down the rabbit hole in terms of exactly how you're structured and the way you do your... But if you're the kind of person that A, spends less than what they earn, invests that regularly into a low-cost ETF, job bloody done. You know, like that is, yes, you're not going to be in the records of history as the next Warren Buffett, but you're going to do incredibly well. And do you really need to pay someone $3,000 to say, hey, spend less than what you earn? Forgo these frivolous things that you don't maybe need that second holiday to Fiji when you've got a $20,000 credit card debt. You know, it's not complicated. It's not complicated. And that's the genius of what this industry has done is try to convince everyone that your precious little brain couldn't comprehend. Let us do it for you because you don't know what you're doing and it's insulting. Yep. And we frankly should teach this stuff in primary school because primary school kids could more than handle the big ideas that matter. Rant over.
Done. Come and join us next Friday. You'll come back next Friday, won't you, Ram?
Any chance for a rant, mate. Any
chance. Exactly. There is a question actually on the on my list I didn't get to. So the good news is we've got more questions. But if you do have questions to ask, please do throw us a question on at TMF Scott P on Instagram or Twitter. Or Scott Phillips Money on Facebook, or info@fool.com.au. We have a question that asks for a rant from you, which I'm partly looking forward to and partly dreading. But that won't be this week. That won't be this week. So do send us a question. If you want to follow Andrew, please do that on Twitter, @Sage_Simeon or @StrawmanInvest. And you'll get great stuff from him, great stuff from me. I feel like the two Ronnies now. It's good night from me and it's good night from him.
I love that show.
Good night.
Good night.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691. Listener.